Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Today I'm speaking with Kathy Shaw. She's the author of The Campaign Manager. She served three terms as the mayor of Ashland, Oregon. She's consulted and lectured widely on campaign management. I'm really excited to have someone from Oregon on the program, especially someone who's been in public office there, because Oregon's been such a laboratory for democratic experimentation, especially for bioethicists like me. You've got that wonderful Kitzhaber guy out there who did the Oregon rationing system, and you've got your assisted suicide stuff going on. So a lot of interesting things, experiments happening in Oregon.
There really are. They're starting from the bottle bill and some of our landmark policies on keeping Oregon beaches open. We have some of the most, I think, successful land use policies in the nation. The representative that I work for, who's currently running for state senate, was one of the architects of the Oregon Health Plan, to which you referred under Governor Kitzhaber, and also serves on the board of Death with Dignity and is actively involved in that as well.
You have written this book, The Campaign Manager, and it's a wonderful season to be talking about the topics in that book, because we have this election season going on and so much money and attention being focused. So I know that there's probably lots of folks who are interested in the lessons that you've pulled out of your experience. And you have, as one of the things that you talk about in your book, the 10 commandments of a good campaign. Why don't we start with that? What are the 10 commandments?
Well, the first commandment is honor your base. And when I talk about a base, I'm referring to the people that will vote for you even if you're in jail. These are people that just will stick with you no matter what. And while they are not people that require a great deal of time, attention, resources, and money, you certainly must acknowledge their support and talk to them from time to time. The second is to stay on your message. We hear this throughout any size campaign, whether it's local, state, or national. The third is money. Money is thy savior, but in this case, I thought I would make it more parallel with the rest of the commandments. Money generally tracks a winner 80% of the time. I have been outspent on many campaigns by opposition. It's not a requisite for winning, but it certainly helps. Never tell a lie is the fourth commandment. Pretty obvious. Aim at the souls that can be saved is the fifth and possibly one of the most important.
What does that mean?
Well, basically, you have the saints, the sinners, and the savables in any campaign. The saints are your base, as I said, the people who will vote for you no matter what. The sinners are those that will never vote for you. You don't want to spend any time or money there. The remaining are the savables, that all too often refer to swing vote or the switch hitters, the people that will move from one party to the next in the same ballot.
Kathy, let's stop there for a second, because there's been a lot of discussion in this last year about the increasing polarization, political polarization in the United States, and the shrinking of the swing, that there are fewer and fewer, even though there are fewer and fewer people in the country who strongly identify with either party, it seems like there are fewer and fewer people who are up for grabs in this
Correct.
Election season. And you agree with that?
Absolutely. There is a great deal of polarization. I know here in the state of Oregon there is, and it looks like it's pretty rampant nationwide. There are those of us that are just firmly on one side and those of us that are firmly on another, and we just simply are not going to move no matter what, how many pieces of direct mail are sent to us, and no matter what is said. The remaining, basically there's 40% that are locked in on either side. That leaves 20% that are up for grabs. That 20%, and people mistakenly think that independent voters are that. They are anything but independent. They are generally people that are aligned with one party or the other. Swing voters can be found among independents, they can be found among Democrats, and they can be found among Republicans. Within my book, I have a section called Precinct Analysis, which helps campaigns to identify exactly where the swing vote lives. And it's all part of the public information and using past voting tendencies of various precincts, you're able to see how many people within a precinct actually move for between individuals in one party or another. One of the best ways to identify the swing vote is to take a campaign in which somebody in your party absolutely tanked, was defeated 5-1. And then you take somebody, who is remaining, that's your base. That's the people who are going to stay with you no matter what. If you win a race where you lost 5-1, those that have voted for you, you're going to vote for you no matter what. You do the same thing on the other side. You find a candidate who lost in the opposition party by a huge margin. And that percentage that stuck with that candidate is the base vote on that other side. The difference between those is actually the swing vote. You will find it within precincts of any voting district, people who simply don't move. They just stick to party. There will be very, very little swing. And then there'll be other areas, irrespective of registration, where there'll be a huge swing vote. That's where you want to spend your time, your resources, your energy, where you want to place your candidate for the canvas.
Have you ever invested in any psychodemographic marketing, looking at your swing voters in terms of what kind of cultural groups they are, what kind of liquor they buy, what kind of magazines they read? There's a bunch of consultants who do this kind of thing.
I know there. When you get down to the precinct level, that data is not generally available. I do, however, do something very similar. I pull out issue-based campaigns that have been voted on in the areas in which my candidate is running, and I look to see how people in a given precinct have voted in the past for those issue-based campaigns. Oregon is a real measure-happy state. We generally have about 35 issue-based campaigns on a statewide ballot, and of course there'll be lots of local elections for schools, libraries, parks, road improvement, all kinds of things. You can really get an excellent roadmap to the thinking and the voting proclivities of any given precinct simply based on past voting practices. You will find out if a particular area is more supportive of law enforcement or schools, is more supportive of, issues regarding environment versus issues regarding business, or all of those things. And then you can actually package your message to these particular neighborhoods based on what their issues are that mean the most to them, and they will in small areas like where you live and where I live, there are very independent, fiercely independent communities that have very, very different voting records, The registration, I got to say, really does not give you a clear enough indication. Gender and age also will not give you a clear indication. Women voters in my town are very different than women voters two towns over. So it's important to overlay voting practices of candidates and parties with issue-based campaigns to give you the very kind of information that you have indicated that expensive firms will find for you. In addition to that, you can go online and look up information about how certain demographics shop or what programs they watch. Right now, for example, my age group, I'm 50 years old, my age group is very interested in home and gardens, and we watch a lot of TV programming on that, and we buy a lot of things to improve our home and the place that we live in. And that can be a good way to kind of get at the programming that people are most receptive to your message and influence them to vote for your candidate. So there are lots and lots of techniques, all free, that an individual can get at in hopes of positioning his or herself in a campaign.
This is Dr. J. This is Change Surfer Radio that you're listening to. I'm speaking today with Kathy Shaw. She's the author of Campaign Manager. She served 3 terms as the mayor of Ashland, Oregon. Okay, so I think I stopped you at Commandment 5 or 6 of your good campaign commandments. What are some of the others?
Halfway through, you stopped me. Never waste donors' money. This is important in government. It's important in nonprofits. a great way that campaigns will often waste donors' money is they'll send 10 or 11 direct mail pieces to a precinct or an area that is wildly supporting that candidate already. Unfortunately, and if I can digress just for a moment, vendors who produce direct mail make money off of each and every piece that they send. So they're anxious to send as many pieces as possible. Seventh Commandment, do not commit adultery. This is pretty obvious. Voters simply don't like that, and that comes in also under the five cardinal sins of campaigning, which I can go over in a moment.
What's the political analog of adultery?
Running for office is extremely hard on any marriage. The candidate will spend a lot of time.
You're talking about actual adultery.
Actual adultery.
Okay. So yeah. Don't get caught in bed with anybody but your spouse.
Yeah. No. Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, it's not just, you know, about sleeping around. It's also about the fact that people understand that a spouse is sacrificing a great deal for the candidate. The one that's left at home, whether it's the, you know, husband, wife, or partner, is responsible for all the house chores, or has additional burdens thrust upon him or her. And certainly that involves child care, it involves bringing money in, it involves taking care of just all the nuts and bolts of running a house. And voters, they know that sacrifice is part of it, and they don't think kindly of a candidate who's off kind of philandering while the spouse is at home holding down the fort.
You didn't learn that one the hard way, I take it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, I did. It's a tough thing on a race. And the thing that's also, or excuse me, tough thing on a marriage, the thing is that very frequently, and I'm going to be a little sexist here, but I find this to be more true with men than women candidates, and I have been working on campaigns for 20 years, and this is the third edition of my book, so I've done a fair amount of research and basis on a lot of background information, personal and otherwise. But men who tend to run for office are often looking for adulation within their community. They're looking for the cheers. They're looking for the support. They're looking to kind of fill out who they are. And that happens with women as well. And then there's also the other type of candidate who's actually really, really interested in executing some important programs that will better the community in which he or she lives. If you're looking for that publicly, many, many times people are also looking for that privately, and it just makes sense. You have a lot of especially women who are helping male candidates. They spend a lot of time with them late night hours, and candidates often have a lot of power, which is very attractive to some people. Candidates need to resist this at all times.
So it's the integrity factor.
It is absolutely the integrity factor, and if you're unhappy with your marriage, deal with that and then move on to other issues. Do not do it simultaneously. It'll cost you an election. The seventh one, start early. This is true probably of all things in life, whether you're going to church or you're running an election. You don't want to be rushing down to wherever you're going. Be prepared in all things. This is true whether you're going to a debate, a forum, or you're just setting up a table for volunteers that are going to come over and work on your campaign. Have enough pencils, enough staplers, enough sponges, glue sticks, whatever you might need. I set up clerical teams in terms of preparing for almost any campaign activity. For example, if I'm going to put up lawn signs one weekend, the weekend before I actually put up the lawn signs, I'll have what I call a clerical team, although it's not exactly clerical. I'll have a group of people come over and assemble those lawn signs for the people putting it up. I'll have another group come over and assemble the packets for where the lawn signs are actually to be placed. Each and every campaign activity can be broken down again and again and again until it's a manageable unit, so that when the next group comes in, they're, for example, lawn signs, they're rushing in, they're picking up a packet of 25, they grab 25 lawn signs, a sledgehammer, and they're out the door. You don't want them to sit down and figure out where they're going or plot out the maps or assemble the signs before pounding in lawn sign stakes for 2 hours.
Okay. Kathy, I've worked in some different campaigns around the country, and mostly in Chicago where I lived for a long time. And one of the things that I noticed about the progressives versus the conservatives that I saw campaigning was that the conservatives often had these kind of grassroots experiences in churches, grassroots links to community institutions, and the progressives were often pretty isolated or not as well connected to kind of intermediate institutions in their community, and so they didn't have as much experience with putting up lawn signs or, you know, organizing committees and things like that. Have you noticed systematic differences between the preparedness or the advantages and disadvantages for progressives versus conservatives around the country?
What you talk about is actually a really interesting topic, because it cuts to I think the whole premise of what a nonprofit tax exempt organization can do. In Oregon, more and more churches are circulating petitions and are advocating for one candidate over another. This is especially in partisan races, is absolutely against the law. You cannot both be tax exempt and be working on political campaigns.
Well, the Republicans in Congress wanted to make it a part of the law. They wanted to explicitly exempt churches in this last this last session of Congress. They wanted to exempt churches from that requirement.
Yeah, we're getting reports from churches throughout Southern Oregon that this practice is continuing. You wonder how much energy you want to spend on it, but they have been very, very successful in organizing their people, especially to sign onto initiatives that often will promote values and issues that they care most about, whether it's dealing with same-sex marriage or issues around choice. The list is actually very, very long, and then, of course, it spills over into candidates as well. The progressives, on the other hand, they do have particular groups that tend to support them, although the unions are falling away a little bit in power, at least here on the West Coast. I don't know if that's true where you are. They often are a great source for organization. Certainly environmental organizations are a great source for campaign volunteers and often have a great deal of know-how. You have to look and see where your base is, who is supporting you. If it's the nurses, if it's teachers, if it's environmental groups, if it's unions, you want to go to those very organizations. Knowing how to fully execute and organize a campaign is not something an individual simply wakes up one day and understands. And that's a huge part of why I wrote this book. I think that well-executed and well-organized campaigns elevates the category of campaigning, and we should strive to do that at all times. It's not a secret how to organize a group, and it's simply that some people don't know how and just need a little direction. And that was the idea behind breaking every single campaign activity down to smaller and smaller units in the campaign manager and fully outlining how those various tasks could be executed.
Did we get all 10 of your commandments?
We have one more.
Okay.
And I say the best for last, and that is know who you are. An individual must clearly have a sense of who he or she is, have a set of core values, and be comfortable with those core values and feel comfortable representing those to the community. Candidates who run on a single issue, who get mad because of a development in their neighborhood or mad because the city council has increased the tax and are going to, by golly, they're going to recall everybody and then run their slate in that place I think that's a fool's errand. A single issue candidates simply are not good candidates, and they do not make good office holders. Recalls rarely make a difference in government. They rarely bring about change, and are very divisive and I think frankly scare good people away from ever wanting to run.
Well, yeah, I think that's definitely true. One of the ironies about the increasing number of women in politics, Barbara Ehrenreich said that it was precisely as global capitalism was robbing governments of their ability to actually have any influence on their own countries, that it was that men had allowed women into politics because there's no more money to be made in it, so we were allowing women in the back door. But
yes, however, it's interesting you should bring that up, because in my in the course of study for my third edition, and I should say that the difference between third edition and second edition is just the amount of documentation I had done on much of the work I'd done in the trenches in southern Oregon on issue-based and candidate races. I wanted, because it is used as a textbook throughout the United States, even though I think of it as a trade book, I wanted to make sure that everything was fully documented and supported by sources outside of my little world. So one of the studies that I looked at were the 11 close House races in the state of Oregon for the 2002 election. These House races I defined by registration. They had to be within 10 points of each other. And I looked at amount of money spent, amount of direct mail pieces sent, number of negative pieces sent, registration. If outside interest groups such as Oregon Right to Life or Oregon League of Conservation Voters weighed in on the race, just anything that was available in the public record, I looked at that. In doing this study, and I first began it because I had was told by a Democratic operative that the reason so many Democrats lost was because they had not sent enough direct mail pieces and they had not hit the Republicans hard enough. It's my personal opinion that negative campaigning, especially in local campaigns, simply does not work. There's no empirical data that suggests it works. I think that oftentimes there are other things that influence it, and negative campaigning is given the credit.
Well, that's a fascinating topic for right now, because we're entering this season, and everyone expects this to be one of the most hostile, negative presidential campaigns ever. The Swift Boat ads and all of this stuff about Kerry's war record. And I confess that, being a progressive, I have lots of Molotov cocktail fantasies about, how aggressive I'd like to get in this campaign. But you're saying that there isn't any evidence that negative campaigning actually works. So why do people do it?
Well, you know what, if I can just proceed just a tiny bit and then come back to that, because it's an important issue that you bring up. But in the 11 close House races that I studied, the dots simply did not cluster anywhere on the map except when I broke things down by gender. Once things were broken down by gender, in five of the 11 races where a female Democrat ran against a male Republican, as opposed to men running against men, and then there were two races that I dropped off because they were just, single, it's small enough sample that it's almost meaningless. But I had five races in which female Democrats ran against male Republicans and four races where men ran against men. Only then was there a clear indication that money tracked the winner. 80% of the time it did there. That mirrors national standards. And in each one of those five races, the female Democrat lost to the Republican man.
Because of money, you're saying?
Well, no. I think, interestingly enough, when I looked at the race, and I interviewed the Republican operatives, and I also looked at direct mail pieces as well, what happened in those races was pretty interesting. In most of the races where the women lost, they had not held public office prior to that, but their husbands had. And it was their husband's voting record on which they were crucified. Because, by golly, we just don't have a head of our own. We're just going to do whatever our husbands tell us. So I found that fascinating in this day and age where women are weighing into this more and more. They are oftentimes the sole breadwinner of their house. They're raising children. They are businesswomen, and yet were successfully attacked because of their husband's voting records and their husbands who had held office before them. It also, because money tracks it, you wonder, is it possible that people believe that the men have a greater chance of winning, or that men are seen as leaders more than women and therefore have an easier time of raising money? So back to your question about negative campaigning.
This will have to be our last topic that we hit, but when does negative campaigning work, if ever?
Well, negative campaigning, there are four areas where I think it will work. And those include when you can, like, for example, when you attack somebody's voting record. This cuts straight to the essence of why we have campaigns. And many people think of this as negative campaigning. I do not. Attacking somebody's voting record or presenting to the voters somebody's voting record, I see as what a campaign should absolutely do. Current ethical problems also fall within fair attacks, as well as current business practices and certainly money received from special interest groups. When I think campaigns overstep their bounds on negative campaigning is when they dredge up stuff about a candidate's personal life in the past, even, you know, for example, if they have declared bankruptcy 10 years before or whatever. And what I do tell candidates is you must come clean to your campaign manager, and in doing that, you list your fatal flaws and you assemble a comprehensive answers that the voters can grab a hold of in response to an attack. This will give a candidate a great deal of comfort. He will be more at ease when he is out there on the campaign trail and be absolutely prepared for anything that might come at him.
Do you, and this will be our absolute last question, 1 minute question, but I like to poke my finger in people's eye, basically, and get an argument started. And I often rationalize it that one of the ways to get attention for a cause and or to get a campaign jump started is to get the negative attention from the right kinds of enemies and, you know, to be attacked in public by the right kinds of people. Do you think that that ever works for a candidate with low name recognition, if they take a controversial stand or they, they get the right kind of people to denounce them in public? Is that a strategy?
I believe that a candidate is known by his or her enemies just as by his or her friends. And so there is something to what you say about the strategy. A campaign should never be the first to go negative. And of course, a candidate must define who he or she is prior to going negative if that's the direction the campaign is going to take. I would never suggest to a candidate to float some bait on the pond just to see who will bite, unless that is an issue that is critically important to that individual. It really depends on the issue. I would have to hear it. I mean, as a campaign manager, I'd want to listen to it and think about, you know, obviously list what the possible ramifications are of coming out on a particular issue, as well as the benefits of coming out. If your opponent, however, attacks you and your opponent unfairly attacks you, your opponent will be hurt by that more than he will be helped. And by the same token, the person being attacked, if the person attacks in a fair way, it is very hard for the campaign originally attacking to ever recover. So there are many, many standards. There are many studies on this. You could Google simply negative campaigning and pull up a number of university studies that have very clearly looked at this information, and certainly within my book I have a lot of it documented. We have made mistakes on both sides, both attacking in a way that we never should have, as well as being attacked in a way that totally worked against us. And I try to present all the successes as well as the failures so people can learn from my mistakes as well as my successes.
Kathy, it's been so good to have this conversation with you, and I hope that lots of the progressives who listen to my show get some benefit from the advice that you've got, and they can look at your book, The Campaign Manager, for more of that. Kathy Shaw served 3 terms as mayor of Ashland, Oregon, and she is a nationally known consultant and lecturer on campaign management. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com, or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.